Blog Talk Radio.
What up, what up, what up? It is the 10th of December. This is the first December episode of the Ant King Experience, because last week I had to cancel because I had to do some overtime at work. And, you know, it's December and a lot of, you know, jobs are doing overtime and all that kind of stuff. So that's why I wasn't here last week. So I'm here tonight. Tonight we're going to talk some history. In case you don't know, the title of the show, we're going to talk about Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott. It's history and, you know, just need to touch base on it for a few, because it is important history. But before I begin on that, I've got a couple of things I just want to get off my chest. And 2 weeks, 2 weeks from tonight will be Christmas Eve, and I'll be doing the annual show on the truth about Christmas, because I don't think a lot of people know the real history about Christmas and the traditions and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of it is not based on religion. Well, it is, but it's not. Because at first, Christmas wasn't a religious holiday, like some people like to claim it is now. It wasn't. So there are a lot of stuff that, you know, you may not know about it, but I'll talk about that in 2 weeks. Because I think that too is important, just like I did the show on Thanksgiving. I think a lot of times, and we already know this, that in this country likes to whitewash history. It likes to try to clean up history to make one side look better than the truth. And I think the myth of Thanksgiving, that pretty much blows that out of the water once you find out what the real history is. And I think Christmas, I think the origin of Christmas is pretty much the same thing. Because, I mean, if you really think about it, the story is Jack. The traditions are Jack. A lot of it doesn't make any sense if you really sit down and think about it logically. And I heard a commercial on the radio this morning. I work third shift, and coming home, I'm kind of tired. But, I mean, I'm still paying attention. And there was a commercial on the radio this morning, and I didn't realize this, and I'm 51 years old, and I think I probably should have realized this by now, but maybe I thought about it and didn't pay any attention to it or whatever. But this time of year is really stressful, and it probably shouldn't be. And the commercial is pretty much saying, you know, talking to adults, you know, pretty much saying that, you know, a lot of people aren't going to have money to buy stuff for the kids and all this kind of stuff. And I mean, and if you think about it, it is stressful. And that's due to commercialism. That's due to capitalism. And that's just due to a whole lot of junk, I think. And it starts with Black Friday, and it goes all the way up until Christmas Eve. And I think if you really think about it, it is, because if you have kids like I do, you know, when they're young, there's no issue. But as they get older, you know, all of a sudden you've got to keep up with what the latest toy is. Then you ask them what they want, and then they come up with this big long list of stuff that they don't need. And then I noticed with my kids that, you know, they would get the stuff on Christmas. They would play with it for a little while, and then after a while, you would find it find a toy in the closet, under the bed, where it doesn't belong, you know. But it's something that they gotta have, and it's something that that the adults seem to think that they gotta get, because they're trying to please the kids. And it doesn't matter what the deal is. If they want something, you got to go beat some old woman up in the store to go get it. You know, I stopped doing that mess a long time ago. My thing is, it just gets to the point where you're going to get what I can afford, and if you don't like it, you know, I'll give it to some kid that wants it. And I just think it's just way too much commercialism. It's just way too much going into debt. It's just way too much headache. And it's just one of those things where people don't need to go into, you know, you still have bills to pay at the end of the day. I mean, you still got lights. I mean, there's a meme running, you know, don't let your Black Friday be your Black Saturday too. You know, you spend all that money on stuff, and then you get your lights turned out. You know, you still got to pay the rent. You still got to do all this other stuff. And I was thinking about that, and I was like, you know, I really didn't think about it, but yeah, you're right. They keep saying that this is a joyous time of year, but the things that people do to stress themselves, doesn't really make a lot of sense. Now, if you've got the money to do it, I mean, well, you know, happy for you. But there are a lot of people in this country that don't have the money to do it. And they shouldn't be, you know, looked down upon because they can't afford some of this stuff. So it's just, you know, one of those things where you sit down and think about it. It is messed up. It is really messed up. So I made it a issue that, you know, I wasn't going into debt for Christmas. At the end of the day, you still have bills and everything else. And then being a man, you know, which is you know, funny that you have, you know, we're the ones that have to, if you get the stuff, you know, a lot of stuff you had to put together, so you have to put a lot of this stuff together. You have to put, you know, batteries in it. You have to do, you know, all kinds of stuff that we have to do. I mean, I didn't mind that part. I thought the part was pretty cool. But now that my kids are grown and I've got grandkids and I work nights, they're a little young to understand it, so I've got to drop their stuff off Christmas morning. I could do it Christmas. No, I can't do it Christmas Eve. I've got to do the show Christmas Eve. So as soon as I get off work Christmas morning, I'm driving straight to their house, drop off their stuff, hang out with them for a few, and then I've got to go to bed. So I got to work the following night. So, but at least they're good. So, you know, I would say that people don't stress yourself out over this. It is, to be honest with you, it is a pagan holiday. I don't get into religion a lot because I don't mess with religion like I used to. So it pretty much is, to me, just a regular day. But, you know, it is what it is. So I'll be doing that show in a couple of weeks. A couple more things, and then we'll get into the thing. Here, you know, some of you may know, some of you may not know, I'm in North Carolina. I have a couple of towns that have decided to not have Christmas parades because of a certain group of people that seem to can't let go of the Civil War, which is a war that, by the way, their side lost. So they didn't want them in the parade. So instead of telling them that you're not welcome in the parade, they just decided not to have the parade altogether. I would have told them to kick rocks and then had the parade. But nobody asked me. I would have told them to kick rocks. And these are the same people that are running around here crying and moaning and bitching about statues, which leads me into the next thing I'm going to do. If nothing happens, probably this Saturday, I am going to have a Facebook video, since they let me out of Facebook jail, because I told Truth to Power about something and they got upset about it and they put me in Facebook jail for 30 days. And I really think we need to have an alternative to Facebook. Because the only reason I got on it because friends and family. But I think right now it's pretty jacked up that they don't seem to have a problem with fights, with videos of people getting into fights over stupid shit. But when I post something that, you know, that is a truthful statement, I mean, they didn't even tell me what I got in trouble for. But when I tell the truth about something, all of a sudden, I can't do certain things for 30 days. But you can have all the fight videos you want. You know, it doesn't make any sense. But anyway, there is a Confederate statue in my hometown that I am going to bring awareness to that I don't think a lot of people are aware of. So I'm going to drive down there Saturday morning because downtown in my hometown on the weekends is dead. So I can go down there and take video of it and talk about it and all that kind of stuff, and nobody probably won't bother me. So I'm going to do that Saturday morning to bring awareness to this thing, because I think one of the things I'm thinking about doing next year is holding my first rally, and it may have to do with this statue. So I'm going to go down there and do the video and see what happens, see what people think, because I think it's important to talk about it. Whether or not they, you know, whether or not I can talk somebody into bringing it down or whatever, we'll see how it goes. They bought down the statue at UNC, and then UNC turned around and paid the organization that put up, what, $2.5 million? Those statues belong in museums, point blank. I did a show on these statues a while ago, and you may have to go into the archives and look it up, but those statues are not put up for history. They were put up for intimidation. I'm seeing nobody's intimidated by them anymore. The only people sitting there crying about them are the neo-Nazis, the neo-Confederates. In other words, the side that lost. So this country is letting the side that lost the war, that wanted to separate from America, letting them just do and say and just have these statues all over the place. And if you're somebody that don't like them, then you're the one that's got the problem. That's bullshit. The statues have nothing to do with the war. What they have to do is Jim Crow, intimidation, the lost cause, because the war ended in 1865. A lot of these statues didn't go up until 10, 15, 20, 30 years after the fact. So if it's all about history, why didn't they go up as soon as the war was over? And then, since the war was about slavery, why don't we have any monuments up for slaves? We don't, because the story has always been one-sided. So I'm going to go down there Saturday morning, take the video and see what happens. And I should have, I don't know why, I did see this, one of the things I've seen it, I've never paid any attention to it, and it was brought up to me by somebody on Facebook, and it's like, yeah, you're right, so I need to investigate it. So I did a little video before about these statues that were in downtown Raleigh, and they're Confederate. Matter of fact, they say on the front, to our Confederate dead. And they're downtown Raleigh, and there's all kinds of people downtown Raleigh that walks past, sees these things on a daily basis. And I think they need to be bought up. And if people get mad about it, well, you know what? I don't really care. You can get mad all you want to. Put on a cape, be super mad. I don't care. But I'm going to go down there and do what I got to do to bring attention to it. And the last thing I want to talk about right quick is your orange president. And he's being impeached for being a crook. Now, he's not going to get kicked out of office for this. But they're bringing up the impeachment because he is a lying sack of shit. He's not above the law. And see, this goes back to white supremacy in this country. They made the rules, which means they can break the rules, which means they can bend the rules. Nobody else can, but they can. And we tried to tell y'all from the jump, when this clown was running, that he ain't about nothing. And he ain't about nothing. Because it's funny, when some other people get accused of groping women, sexual assault, they have to, you know, they have to lose their jobs and all that kind of mess, blah, blah, blah. Not this clown. He's been accused of over 20 women. He's still doing his thing. He's still lying. You know, they wanted to impeach Obama over a tan suit. And I don't think Obama ever asked Russia or Ukraine for help. But the whole mess is a hot mess. And his fans are about as dumb as he is. And I think I have to keep telling these knuckleheads, they don't want to listen. But we're in the position we're in now is because not of somebody else. It's because of him. He caused it. He did it. So if they want to blame somebody, don't pull the Obama card and blame Obama for something that he ain't had nothing to do with. Blame it on the person that caused all this mess. It's him. He did this. Nobody else did this. But they are forever blaming everybody else for this clown's fuck-ups. You know, he will not stand up and take, you know, and be like, my bad. He won't take responsibility for it. And tonight he's having another Klan rally somewhere. And they'll have it on TV, and then you'll have the token blacks standing behind them that answer the ad on Craigslist to be stand-ins, and they will pay you $15 an hour to stand there looking stupid, holding signs, being sellouts. And he's talking about nothing. You know, and just remember this. All of this started. I was talking to a friend of mine at work, and we think there's two things. He thought he brought up something that was interesting. I didn't think about it. The only reason why he ran, two reasons why I think he ran. The first reason why I think he ran because he wanted to build hotels in Russia. And you have to remember that his name is a brand, like Nike, like Reebok, like McDonald's. And even though his hotels are, from what I heard, are shitty, I'm not going to stay in one. Are real shitty hotels. He doesn't, you know, he uses a lot of illegal labor in his places, but he won't come out and say it. But he pretends to hate people from south of the border. And those are the only ones working in these shitholes that nobody else with sense would even work in. But he wanted to build hotels in Russia. And the other thing is that when they were doing the correspondence dinner, Obama did. Obama was at one, and he went slam off on him. And I forgot what the year was, but you can look it up on YouTube. And they kept showing Trump sitting there with this look on his face, like he was mad. I mean, he wasn't going to do anything. He just like he was mad because Obama was cracking on him. Well, we used to call back in the day, I claimed the dozens. When you crack on, you tell jokes about somebody, and if they're game, they won't get mad. You know, they'll sit there and laugh, and then they'll come back, and, you know, I got to be pretty good at doing that. I don't know why. But we used to do that. We used to do that stuff all the time, especially boys. Boys would do that stuff all the time. We'd all get in a circle, and we just crack jokes, and it'd be like two people, you know, usually go two at a time, and they would just sit there and crack jokes on each other. They go back and forth. you know, your mama jokes, you know, stuff like that, and they go back and forth. And, you know, the thing was not to get mad, because the first time you get mad, the game is over. You lost. So you have to be quick on your feet, and you have to, you know, think or whatever. And he was at one of these things, and Obama was going ham on her, and he got mad. And that's probably why he decided to run him, so he can get in and, you know, try to get back over at Obama, because, you know, all the stuff that he did to get back at Obama, you know, he was just pissed. Well, he's a child anyway, because if you see him on Twitter, he acts like a damn 3-year-old. But, you know, America wanted him, you got him. So he's dumb. I mean, he's straight up stupid. So all of this shit that we're going through right now is because of one person and one person only, him. Him. And the jacked up thing about this, which makes no sense, is that he held aid from a country. He wanted them to investigate, but the thing was, they weren't going to investigate. The only thing he wanted from them was to get on TV, for the president of Ukraine to get on TV and say that we are investigating Biden. They weren't going to really do an investigation. He just wanted them to come out and say it, because you know why? Because once it gets out there and his minions hear it, then for Biden, it's a wrap. It's a wrap. So he didn't want them to actually investigate. He just wanted them to get on TV and say that they were investigating. Because Trump knows his followers are stupid, and they will believe anything he tells them. So he's not investigating. He doesn't want an investigation for corruption. He just wants them to investigate just to say that they investigate. And they won't. They won't going to do it. So this guy's a clown. He lies. He ain't about nothing. We tried to tell you. I tried to tell you. He gets in. He plays more golf than Tiger Woods. He gives his buddy tax breaks that they don't need. Everybody else is sitting around here working 2 and 3 jobs. I've done it. I've done it before. Now I'm working 2 jobs. Hopefully I can cut it down to 1 job. But there are a lot of people out here working 2, 3 jobs trying to make ends meet, because everything else is going up but wages. And he wants to sit here and blame everybody else for his bullshit. And his dumbass fans believe everything he says, which is why everybody, all these other countries around the world are laughing at us. He went to a summit last week. Some of the leaders were talking shit behind his back. He gets mad and comes home. But him and his cult followers, they will talk shit about everybody all day long. But when the stuff is reversed and put on him, all of a sudden he gets his panties twisted, and now he's mad. He's pathetic. He gets pathetic. So if you voted for this clown, that was a wasted vote. But, you know, now that I got it off my chest, I'm good to go. So I've got 5 clips. We're going to talk a little bit about Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott, which is important, because I think a lot of that, I think the feeling behind that, you know, we're going through that now, which is, you know, something's going on and we're sick of it and it needs to change. And we've got stuff going on right now that, you know, a lot of people are just getting really tired of it. You know, it's just getting to the point we're just, I'll say in my hood voice, we're just getting really fucking tired of it. Just getting tired of it. Because you have to remember back then, and I think the 50s, this is what, yeah, well, I don't think, but in the 50s is where this started, but whenever these clowns running around here talking about Make America Great Again, they're talking about the 50s. This is the point in time where they're talking about, and it was only great for white people. It wasn't great for anybody else. It was great for white people. And I think one of these clips I got, I think it'll touch on that. It was great for white folks, but it wasn't great for the brothers or the sisters. So this is the time they're talking about. They won't come out and say it, but this is what they were talking about. So you have to remember back then, you know, black people were treated like, you know, they weren't slaves, but they were treated second-class citizens. They couldn't eat in the same restaurants. They couldn't, they couldn't even use the same water fountains. When they went to movies, they had to sit in the balcony. They had to come in through the back doors of the restaurants. When they rode buses, they had to sit in the back of the bus. They could sit at the front of the bus as long as there weren't no white people sitting on the bus. But whenever white people got on the bus, they had to get up and move and go to the back of the bus. As a matter of fact, a lot of these buses had side doors and back doors that they had to go out those doors. So what's a whole lot of mess going on? You know, black people living in substandard housing, have sucky jobs, you know, which have been going on since, you know, they bought the first slave over. And it just got to the point in this country that black people were just getting tired of it. And they wanted stuff to change. And we are at that point right now that we are just getting tired of it. We wouldn't be tired of it if we hadn't elected a certain orange douchebag into the office, but they did, and he's there, and he's not doing a damn thing, and we're tired of it. So black people in the 50s, matter of fact, this happened in 1955, 64 years ago. Well, no. This happened in the 50s. But this particular thing with Rosa Parks happened on December 5th, 1955. So this has been picking up and going on. But people are just getting fed up. And things have to change. And, you know, and so what do you, one of the things that you can make change if you hit people in the pocketbook. So black folk boycotted the Montgomery bus system for a year. You know, because sometimes you have to hit them in the pocketbook. Because if you boycott, you know, and sometimes we see that now with some corporations. I mean, if something happens, I don't remember where it was, but there was a hair shop somewhere, and you know, and the thing that, well, this goes off on something else. I think a lot of these hair stores should be owned by sisters, because they're the ones that go into these things all the time. They understand what the product is. They should own 95% of these stores, but they don't. But there was an incident where, you know, black people were getting harassed in these stores, and so they got boycotted. And as soon as those dollar signs dropped, then all of a sudden change was made. So you know, some of the stuff, if you hit them at the bottom line, all of a sudden they'll see the light and they'll want to change. They'll come back, oh, I am so sorry. I didn't, let me help you. Let me help you into, oh, did you, you know. Which is pretty sad. Because if you're in business, you're supposed to, you know, take care of everybody. Because money is still green. Everybody still has money. You know, my thing is, if, you know, if you don't want my money, that's cool. I'll take my money and I'll go somewhere else. That's why I will not go into to places that have on Fox Noise. I'll take my money and go somewhere else. That's why I won't do business. When I make my drive to work, there's a store that sells flowers and stuff like that for the garden and everything. Well, these peckerheads have the nerve to fly a Trump flag. So guess what? They are never going to get my business. So anybody that does anything that, you know, I don't know, you know, and you know, people will say, oh, this, you know, no, it's my money. I spend my money the way I want to spend my money. And if you're doing something that I don't agree with or whatever, then I don't have to give you my money. I can take my money and go somewhere else. You know, I'm sure you can fill my spot with somebody else, which is fine. Because it's my money, I made it, and I can spend it how I want to. And so I think a lot of times these people, you know, they may not, you know, they may not like minorities or, you know, whatever. Sometimes they'll say it, sometimes they won't. But as soon as they do, and you got a boycott, all of a sudden their minds are going to change pretty quick. Because once they start seeing those dollars dropping, then all of a sudden... So right now, with some of these businesses, they don't want to say anything or do anything stupid, because the reason why they call it Black Friday is because they want to be in the black when 2020 rolls in. If you're in business and you're in the red, you're in trouble. You want to be in the black. So they're not going to do or say anything stupid for the next couple of weeks. Oh, and by the way, if I didn't say it, and I think I don't know if I did or not, happy holidays. Because some people believe you that Christmas is the most important time of this year. Nope, it's not. There are other holidays going on at the same time of Christmas. So I say happy holidays, because I have no idea what holiday you take part in, but have a good one. So people get mad because, you know, if you get mad at somebody telling you happy holidays, you got some serious issues. You need to go get checked. Because I will tell somebody happy holidays in a second, because there are other things going on besides Christmas. You got Hanukkah, you got Kwanzaa, you got all kinds of stuff going on. Because everybody doesn't observe the same religious things that you do. So if I tell you happy holidays, I'm not trying to be funny. I'm just trying to, you know, we're going to cover all the holidays. It's pretty basic. It's not that complicated. People make stuff complicated because they want to be complicated. And it's not that serious. But people with mental defects want to make stuff serious because they got nothing better to do. So, like I said, we got 5 clips. I'm going to play them because I've got to get out of here on time because I have to go to work. But that's cool. We got time. The clock in my phone is weird. Whatever. Okay. All right. So let's play this first one. And you find it. Okay. Be right back.
We all know the story of Mrs. Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott. We learned it in school as a neat, tidy story of individual heroism. Mrs. Parks, a seamstress tired after a hard day at work, courageously sat down. A young preacher, Dr. Martin Luther King, charismatically stood up. They inspired people to march and change happened. Well, let me tell you the story in a way you might not have heard it before. Let's begin with Rosa Parks. Born in 1913, she was the granddaughter of slaves. She was a good student, soft-spoken, but strong-willed. Her family believed in standing up against mistreatment. One time when a white boy on roller skates tried to push her off the sidewalk, she pushed back. Mrs. Parks reflected later, "I'd rather be lynched than run over by them." In 1931, she met Raymond Parks, a self-taught, politically active barber. He was the first man she deemed radical enough to marry. He was active in the Scottsboro 9 case, in which 9 young men had been falsely accused of rape. The Communist Party of America financed their defense, and Mr. Parks became an activist in the effort. In December 1943, Mrs. Parks attended her first NAACP meeting. She was the only woman there and was elected group secretary that day, a position she'd hold for the next 12 years. As secretary, she recorded countless cases of unfair treatment, brutality, sexual violence, and lynchings. The local president of the NAACP and her partner for over a decade was Edie Nixon, a member of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union, who had also been active in registering voters, including Mrs. Parks. He and Parks were the first working-class people to lead a local NAACP. They were eventually elected as state president and secretary as well. Through the NAACP, Ms. Parks attended meetings in Jacksonville, Atlanta, and Washington, D.C., where she received leadership training from the legendary NAACP organizer Ella Baker, who became a role model and mentor to her. Ms. Baker also inspired Parks to create a youth council in Montgomery. Fred Gray was a 24-year-old attorney who had recently moved to town, only the second African-American lawyer in Montgomery and the 12th in the state. Rosa Parks took him under her wing, regularly meeting him for lunch and encouraging him to take on civil rights work. Clifford and Virginia Duer were the town's leading white liberals. One day, Mrs. Parks was working for Virginia Duer when they discussed her NAACP work. Mrs. Duer suggested she attend the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee, where integrated groups of activists developed their leadership in civil disobedience. Clifford Duer was a board member, and the Duers raised money to send Ms. Parks to a two-week-long workshop on civil rights. At Highlander, she and 47 other diverse activists lived in an integrated community and developed their strategies and tactics as leaders. She came to admire Highlander director Miles Horton's spirit and sense of humor. She was in awe of Septima Clark, the lead instructor who, like Ms. Baker, became a role model and mentor for her as women activists. The workshop rejuvenated her, but she was pessimistic about the prospects of a mass movement in Montgomery. While at Highlander, Claudette Colvin, the 15-year-old secretary of the Youth Council, was on her mind. On March 2, 1955, Ms. Colvin refused to move to the back of the bus and was arrested. Her arrest outraged the community. While Mrs. Parks and Mrs. Duer raised money for her case, the male leaders in town were concerned that she was too dark-skinned, poor, and young to be sympathetic plaintiff to challenge segregation. On October 21, 1955, 18-year-old Mary Louise Smith, another youth council member, refused to move to the back of the bus and was arrested. She was also considered too poor and young to be sympathetic. On Thursday afternoon, December 1, 1955, Rosa Parks refused to move to the back of the bus and was arrested. The same bus driver, James Blake, had thrown Mrs. Parks off his bus in 1943 for refusing to move. She said, "I'd felt for a long time that if I was ever told to get up so a white person could sit, that I would refuse to do so." Now, does she sound like the accidental activist we've learned about in school and popular culture, the tired seamstress who just wanted to rest her feet after a hard day at work? She often said that the only thing she was tired of was being segregated and mistreated. Edie Nixon and the Duers went to get her out of jail. Nixon saw opportunity to use Mrs. Parks' case as an ideal plaintiff to challenge segregation. Raymond Parks didn't agree. After much debate, she and Raymond made the difficult, courageous choice, knowing they'd probably lose everything as a result, and they lost a lot, including their jobs in the process. Mrs. Parks called Fred Gray and asked him to represent her. He called Joanne Robinson, a leader of the Women's Political Council, a group of African-American women who had been calling for a bus boycott. She called Edie Nixon, and they agreed to call for a bus boycott Monday, the day of Mrs. Parks' arraignment. Overnight, Miss Robinson printed more than 15,000 flyers at Alabama State College calling for the boycott. Can you imagine making 15,000 flyers on 2014 technology, let alone 1955 technology? And this was especially risky since the university was funded by the segregationist state legislature. The Women's Political Council members met her at dawn and fanned the community with flyers. At 6 a.m., Edie Nixon phoned Reverend Ralph Abernathy of First Baptist Church and suggested a meeting of pastors that afternoon. Reverend Abernathy suggested that the newest pastor in town, Martin Luther King, at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church would be a good host because he had no set alliances, enemies, and had less to lose if it didn't work out. Dr. King was reluctant at first but eventually agreed. About 50 pastors met that night with Rosa Parks and Joanne Robinson and agreed to support the boycott from the pulpits on Sunday and announce a mass meeting for Monday night. One white pastor, Robert Grace, attended the meeting. He led Trinity Lutheran Church, an African-American congregation, and was an outcast among whites in Montgomery. He hosted Mrs. Parks' NAACP Youth Council meetings at his church and was a friend of hers. He remained an important ally throughout the boycott. His home was eventually bombed. On Saturday, Ms. Parks went to Alabama State College, where she was conducting a leadership training for the NAACP. She was discouraged when only 5 students attended. She was no longer discouraged on Monday, however, when she and other leaders marveled at the empty buses and streets filled with African-American citizens walking to school and work. The boycott was on. Rufus Lewis was a businessman and rival of Edie Nixon's. He did not want Nixon to lead the new Montgomery Improvement Association that was created to sustain the boycott. So he nominated his pastor, Dr. King, to lead it, arguing that he was a neutral choice and hoping he could pull strings from behind. That is how Dr. King was drafted into movement leadership. That night, 15,000 people attended a mass meeting, and the new 26-year-old MIA president, Dr. King, gave a prophetic speech that inspired them to commit to the boycott. Mrs. Parks never spoke or was consulted on strategy. Sexism, the desire to make her into a more sympathetic plaintiff, converted the experienced leader into the tired seamstress of civil rights myth. Dr. King had spoken with a pastor in Baton Rouge, where they had had a two-week-long bus boycott in 1953, and learned about the carpool system they implemented to get residents to school, work, church, and shopping errands. He assigned Rufus Lewis to put together a transportation plan that involved 350 cars providing thousands of rides each day for 12 months. Mrs. Parks at times worked as a dispatcher. A. Philip Randolph, leader of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union and dean of America's Civil Rights Leadership, sent his best organizer and strategist to Montgomery to help out. Bayard Rustin was a true outsider, a former Communist Party organizer, a pacifist who was jailed for refusing to fight in World War II, and an openly gay black man in 1955. In February, when he arrived, the police had indicted 115 members of the Montgomery Improvement Association. Rustin, a devoted Gandhian who'd spent 6 months in India, recommended to Nixon that they put on their Sunday best, go down to jail, and turn themselves in. They did so, confounding city leaders. Nixon, Robinson, Parks, and King all believed to varying degrees in self-defense. They all owned guns. Nixon and King's homes had been bombed. Protesters had been attacked. King had actually applied to the governor of Alabama for a permit to carry a gun in his car. Bayard Rustin advised them to get rid of the guns, and he mentored them on nonviolent civil disobedience throughout the campaign. Many others stepped up too. Georgia Gilmore created the Club From Nowhere, and Inez Ricks created the Friendly Club to organize women to make and sell sandwiches, dinners, pies, and cakes during the week to raise money for the Montgomery Improvement Association. Every Monday, they would compete to see who could bring the most money to the mass meetings. Ella Baker and Bayard Rustin formed an organization in friendship to also raise money for the movement. Miss Baker took Mrs. Parks on fundraising trips up north. In May, they hosted a fundraising event featuring Rosa Parks at Madison Square Garden that attracted 16,000 people. But Rosa Parks had been an NAACP officer and organizer for more than a decade. Her husband had been active in an effort funded by the Communist Party. So it was decided that she too was a controversial plaintiff. So another woman who'd refused to move to the back of the bus was chosen to be the lead plaintiff, Aurelia Browder. The Supreme Court struck down segregation in the case of Browder versus Gale, and on December 20, 1956, 382 days after Mrs. Parks' courageous act, the boycott was over and the buses were integrated. So who was the leader of the Montgomery bus boycott? All of them. Social change always comes from the leadership of the many. We need all kinds of people to step up and play different roles to achieve social change. You can take any part of the civil rights movement or any other social movement and tell a similar story, and you could add many more names to this story. It does not diminish the courage of Mrs. Parks or the prophetic vision of Dr. King to acknowledge that their leadership was part of a larger leadership narrative. We need to see leadership as an action many can take, not just a position few can hold. Leadership is a muscle that everyone has, and it only gets stronger with exercise and practice. We need to build the collective leadership muscles of our organizations and communities if we want to create change. We need to support programs like Public Eyes and community organizing efforts that build the leadership of the many. When the police interrogated Claudette Colvin about who was behind the boycott, she responded, "Our leaders is just we ourselves." That should be our call to action. Step up.
Okay. All right. That was number one. Before I go to the next clip, let me get this thing together. Let me hit the button and. All right. Hey, what's going on?
Hey, Anthony, what's happening?
Hey, what's up?
You know, I know E.D. Nixon's grandson. His name is Lionel. Wasn't in St. Louis. He's now in Chicago. Did you know that E.D. Nixon wanted to go to Winston-Salem, North Carolina and talk to the people, the black people there who ran a bus company called a Safe Bus Company. You can Google that. They had over 500 buses at the time. Sometime Claude Anderson talks about it. I don't know if he was related to the people or not. But it was a highly efficient bus company that was vertically integrated from the bottom to the top. But the conveners of the boycott movement, other than E.D. Nixon, did not want to do that.
You said the name of it is the Safe Bus, Company?
Safe, S-A-F-E.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, yeah, I'm gonna Google that and check that out. Because, matter of fact, I'm a couple hours away from Winston-Salem. Okay.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, I've been a while, but yeah. It's right on the other side of, it's right up there near Greensboro, High Point, up in that area.
Then also, let's see. The buses was ran by what's called a national bus line, and the national bus line was on national city lines. I'm sorry. National City Lines was owned by General Motors. And the president of General Motors at that time was Albert P. Sloan. And it was Albert P. Sloan, Rockefeller, and Firestone that went to Eisenhower to build the interstate highway system. And when they done that, it effectively put electric streetcars out of business. We had one in St. Louis at the time. It's Bourne, that they call them, was there on Delmar and De Bolivar. Matter of fact, the powerhouse, the electrical powerhouse that they generated electrical power in order to power the streetcars throughout their routes through the city. And we had one that ran clean out to Creve Coeur Park. So that brought about the demise of alternative energy that was being utilized back at that time. Now, another person that played a major part in the boycott was an African-American gentleman by the name of Gaston, A.G. Gaston. You ever heard of him?
I don't think so. Let me write his name down. Gaston, A.G., okay.
A.G. Gaston was a businessman, African American, and when he died, he was worth over $100 million. And actually, he gave away half of his wealth to his employees. A.G. Gaston was born in the latter part of 1800s. And him and his mother started a business, and they were selling sandwiches to the miners. You know, when they came out the mine for lunch, they'd be there with the sandwiches. Then he went on into other business things. And some of them you're going to recognize. He went into the burial insurance business. Okay. And he went into other businesses too. And they was dealing with, let's see, burial insurance. He had businesses that dealt in insurance, period. He started a popsicle company called Brown Cow. And
oh,
that didn't last too long. Huh?
Brown Cow, okay. Oh,
Brown Cow, yeah. It didn't last too long because
okay.
the employees were stealing the sugar.
Oh, wow.
He also started a company. He also started an educational company called, it was the Booker T. Washington Secretariat School. And he was married to a woman named Winnie. And she worked in the school too. And Winnie went before Congress because what they were doing, he needed the secretaries for his businesses. And there was no means of producing them, so he started a school teaching, you know, black women to be secretaries. Okay, and they was paying part of the tuition, and it got to be such a large undertaking that they said, well, you know, we can't keep doing this. So she went and petitioned Congress to come up with what today is called, guess what? Student
Pell
loans. Grant. Yeah.
Oh. Mm.
Now, during the boycott, and you know, Winnie was the father. Winnie was the daughter of a guy who owned a funeral home. And that's how they got into the business of funeral homes. You know, back during that time, blacks was being buried by blacks, not being buried by whites. So, Gaston married Winnie, and then he got into the business of providing those policies. And the first people that he wrote, guess what? They died. They upped and died. Well, I don't know how many it was, but he just barely started the business. And here now he's got to pay out for a barrel. So he worked a deal out with the undertaker and said, look, if I can bring you a lot of business, can I get a discount? And the undertaker agreed, and thus how his business kicked off. He built a hotel in Memphis, and that's where, you know, during that time, the civil rights people handed the place to stay and also to meet, and he provided them with that, you know, in this hotel. And that was in Birmingham. He got with the white business people and convinced them to take the colored and white signs down in the water fountains in their stores. That was him who done it. He defied Bull Connor. I know you heard that name before, right?
Oh, yeah. Matter of fact, he's in, I think he's in the next, is it next clip? I think he's in the next clip that I'm going to play. Yep.
Yeah,
He defied
Bull Connor. Now, guess what else Bull Connors shows up at? Bull Connors used to announce baseball games for the Birmingham Black Barons. You know who played for the Birmingham Black Barons?
Oh,
Willie
Michael
Mays.
Jordan.
Oh, Michael Jordan wasn't even born then, man. What are you talking about?
No, I ain't talking about he wasn't born then. I'm talking about he played for them later on when he retired from basketball. We got another call. Let me bring this call in.
Now let me forget the story now. It's starting to get good.
Okay. Hey, welcome to the show.
I'm sorry. I'm just
Hey, what's
listening.
Going on?
Okay, how are you? I'm just listening.
Hey, how you doing? I haven't heard from you in a while. What's going on with you?
Doing all right. Doing okay. Nice to hear you guys on again. Yes, I'm just listening.
Oh,
no comment. Yes, thank you.
Okay. All right, no problem.
Yeah.
No problem.
So, Bull comes to broadcast the baseball games for the Birmingham Black Barons, which Willie Mays played for. So, going on, Gaskin was against the strategist using kids, black kids, being waterholed and sicked by the dogs. Okay. And we know we've seen pictures of that. In the marches, blacks used to get locked up. And they, of course, would get locked. Had to come up with money to get them out. It was, and the organizations that was involved with it was the Big Six. I can't think of their names, and I'll try to come up with them before it's over. But them took over $300,000, is being reported, of his own money, and paid the bail release of protesters who was locked up in jail.
Matter of fact,
and
I'm going to play that next because I think this is the one that Bull Connor is in. Yeah, I think this is it. Yeah, this is it. So they're going to talk about that.
So I'm going to stop right there. Go ahead and play. And I used to have some notes on that. And I'm up, come with me. It's still interesting.
Okay, I'll play it because we're kind of up against 8:30 anyway. So I'll go ahead and get this in. Here we go.
You can never whip these buds if you don't keep you and them separate. I found that out in Birmingham. You've got to keep the white and the black separate.
In May of 1963, one individual in Birmingham, Alabama, reinvigorated the wilting civil rights movement. Bull Connor, Birmingham's Commissioner of Public Safety, ordered the use of fire hoses and police dogs to quell demonstrations pushing for desegregation in Birmingham. In an ironic twist, however, by defending segregation so fervently, Bull Connor actually called national attention to the civil rights movement and dramatized its goals. His violent actions brought the immediate end to segregation in Birmingham, solidified his legacy as a symbol of bigotry, and, most importantly, hastened the passage of major civil rights legislation. Starting in the 1950s, dramatic changes began to sweep the entire nation. Following the landmark decision in Brown v. Board of Education in 1954 and the success of the Montgomery bus boycott in 1956, America found itself amidst an ever-strengthening civil rights movement. In 1962, however, the movement met its first significant setback in Albany, Georgia. The Albany movement was largely a failure. Because it lacked a clear-cut focus and failed to arouse an aggressive response from the police department, the campaign stalled. In August of 1962, the leader of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., left the city of Albany. According to King, the Albany movement's aims were so vague that we got nothing, and the people were left depressed and in despair. Although King left Albany crestfallen, he quickly refocused his attention on finding a way to regain momentum. King and other civil rights leaders sought someone that would display to the world the grim reality of segregation in the South. It didn't take long to find such an individual. Born in 1897, Theo Phyllis Eugene Connor achieved local fame in Birmingham after dropping out of high school and becoming a baseball radio announcer in 1921. Due to his booming voice, Connor earned the nickname Bull and eventually became, according to one publication, one of Dixie's most popular announcers. In 1934, Bull Connor launched his career in politics by becoming a member of the Alabama House of Representatives. According to Connor, he ran partly for the fun of it and partly to see how many friends I had. Despite his superficial motives and modest beginnings, Connor eventually would become one of the most infamous men in the South. By 1963, Connor had already gained his reputation for defending segregation at all costs. Over the past two decades, he had dominated Birmingham's political scene. Serving as the Commissioner of Public Safety, Connor controlled both the police department and the fire department. Connor frequently used his power to enforce Birmingham's stringent segregation ordinances, or, as he referred to them, our way of life. Bull Connor's Birmingham had become an international symbol of segregation and racism. The city was referred to as Bombingham for the numerous unsolved bombings by the Ku Klux Klan during Connor's reign. In 1962, Connor ordered the closure of over 60 of Birmingham's parks rather than follow a court's order to desegregate public facilities. According to Dr. King, Birmingham was the most thoroughly segregated city in the United States. After the failure of the Albany movement, local civil rights leaders implored Dr. King to make Birmingham the next target of the civil rights movement. The Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth told King, "If you come to Birmingham, the movement can not only gain prestige, it can really shake the country." With such a strong incentive, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference began planning for the campaign in Birmingham. It would be called Project C, for confrontation.
May I have the feeling that if we can get a breakthrough in Birmingham and really break down the walls of segregation, it will demonstrate to the whole South, at least the hardcore South, that it can no longer resist integration.
Since African Americans comprise 40% of the consumer population in Birmingham, the SCLC decided to target segregation primarily in the business section of the city through economic boycott and prolonged demonstrations. The leaders of Project C also hoped that it would serve as a template for future resistances in southern cities. According to Shuttlesworth, "We wanted confrontation, nonviolent confrontation, to see if it would work on a massive scale, not just for Birmingham, for the nation." After small-scale demonstrations in April, the leaders of Project C decided to use a revolutionary new tactic. The final phase of the movement would focus on mobilizing hundreds of Birmingham's youth. On Thursday, May 2nd, the first children began demonstrating. By the end of the day, Bull Connor and his police force had arrested 959 children, ranging from ages 6 to 18. Over the next few days, Connor continued defending segregation at all costs.
"Do you think you can keep Birmingham in the present situation of segregation?"
"I may not be able to do it, but I'll die trying."
Connor ordered his police and fire departments to use dogs and hoses to crush these massive demonstrations. To counter King's tactic of nonviolence, Connor pledged to fill the jails. By May 7th, Connor and his police department had already jailed over 3,000 demonstrators. The situation in Birmingham worsened as Connor proceeded with his relentless attack on the demonstrators. Local business leaders began to change their minds about segregation. Because of the economically crippling effect of the boycott and the state of race relations, the Senior Citizens Committee, a group that represented the majority of Birmingham's businesses, agreed to desegregate lunch counters and hire African American workers. Announced on May 10th, the Birmingham Agreement struck an enormous blow for integration. Bull Connor's extreme actions had clearly backfired. But his violent actions would eventually backfire even more.
Bull Connor's recalcitrant behavior and positions allowed the press to be able to focus thoroughly on what was happening within a movement experience.
Over 200 reporters from local and national media outlets captured Connor's segregationist tactics in pictures and video. The stark contrast of vicious dogs and high-powered hoses with young children dramatically stirred the nation's conscience. As Connor attacked the Birmingham Agreement as capitulation by certain weak-kneed white people, President John F. Kennedy began preparing for a monumental address to the nation. Previously, Kennedy had taken a rather lackluster stance on civil rights for African Americans. However, Bull Connor's alarming actions in Birmingham had alerted Kennedy, along with millions of other Americans, of the dire situation in the South. On June 11, 1963, Kennedy delivered an address on civil rights to the nation.
"Now the time has come for this nation to fulfill its promise. The events in Birmingham and elsewhere have so increased the cries for equality that no city or state or legislative body can prudently choose to ignore them. This week I shall ask the Congress of the United States to act, to make a commitment it has not fully made in this century to the proposition that race has no place in American life or law."
Using the momentum from the events in Birmingham, over 250,000 Americans participated in the March on Washington in August of 1963, rallying behind a cry to pass the bill. A year later, President Lyndon Johnson passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The act, which was originally proposed because of Bull Connor's aggressive defense of segregation, outlawed segregation in schools, public places, and employment, and was an enormous step towards equality between different races. On March 10th, 1973, Eugene Bull Connor died. By this time, Connor had lost nearly all of his political power and remained in the minds of Americans as a racist leader in the South. But for the civil rights movement, Connor was so much more than that. Connor became the quintessential representation of racism and prejudice in the South. By pledging to defend segregation at all costs, Connor was the perfect individual around whom the civil rights movement could rally. His attention-grabbing actions were of the utmost of importance for the movement. 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, Connor's use of fire hoses and police dogs on demonstrators not only caused the immediate end of segregation in Birmingham, but also triggered a sequence of events, from Kennedy's proposal of a major civil rights bill to the March on Washington, that directly led to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Connor's story demonstrates how one individual's actions have the power to influence popular opinion and call attention to inequalities in our world. After Connor's downfall, one periodical discussed his influence in Birmingham. Without Bull dominating the Birmingham scene, race relations in the city would have been far in advance of what they are, for in season and out, he gave encouragement, aid, and comfort to the intellectually prehistoric mass mobs who have shot, bombed, and persecuted Negro citizens in an effort to thwart their advance to full manhood status. What this author could not understand, however, was just how crucial Connor's role was in advancing race relations in not only Birmingham, but in the whole nation. Connor has been called the perfect adversary because he embodied all of the ugliness of segregation in the hardcore South. Pictures of his racist actions alerted the nation of the inequality in everyday life in the South and led to an unanticipated revival in the previously wilting civil rights movement. Reflecting back on the events in Birmingham, President Kennedy remarked on the importance of Connor in the civil rights movement. He said, "The civil rights movement should thank God for Bull Connor. He's helped it as much as Abraham Lincoln."
And I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
To Alabama Governor George Wallace, the continuation of segregation was a solemn promise. To Martin Luther King, it was a scourge he vowed to overcome. In the city of Birmingham, the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, whose church and home had been bombed because of his activism, began a campaign to integrate the downtown shopping district. King joined him in March of 1963. They both expected an extreme response from Public Safety Commissioner, segregationist Eugene Bull Connor.
One of the good fortunes of the civil rights movement were its enemies. Where could you find a better enemy than Bull Connor of Birmingham?
King submitted to arrest on April 12th, Good Friday, to draw maximum press coverage. Attorney General Robert Kennedy had asked King to avoid confrontations with police, wanting to pursue civil rights gains through the courts, not the streets.
Dr. King said, "Mr. Attorney General, I can best serve this country and my people by focusing on the evils of segregation." He said, "It's a corruption of the society. It's a corruption of the soul."
Sitting in his jail cell in Birmingham, King wrote about that corruption. He responded to an open letter that appeared in the Birmingham News that same day. It was titled, "A Call for Unity," and was signed by 8 white clergymen. Their appeal made reference to outside leadership, calling the protests unwise and untimely. King wrote in the margins of that newspaper, "I am in Birmingham because injustice is here." He went on, "Birmingham is probably the most thoroughly segregated city in the United States. Its ugly record of brutality is widely known." The sentiments King expressed in the letter had already made an impact on students who had committed themselves to civil rights activism throughout the Deep South.
"We were greatly influenced by Martin Luther King Jr. and the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. But we didn't like the tempo of change. We wanted to speed it up."
On May 3rd, students re-energized the campaign. Some were in high school, others were even younger. The Birmingham campaign became known as the Children's Crusade.
It was easy for black students like myself in the South to say, "Well, if they can do it in Little Rock, if they can do it in Montgomery, if they can stand up, we can stand up too."
Connor and the police represented...
When Bull Connor ordered the police to disperse the protesters with dogs, it was clear this was a real battle, a violent confrontation. Firemen were ordered to use the full force of their hoses on the demonstrators. The local newspapers supported Bull Connor's response, blaming the chaos on the demonstrators.
I really believe he thought somehow in some way that he was scared. But he didn't understand the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. He didn't understand the spirit of the movement.
Television and newspaper reports captured the brutality in Birmingham and showed it to the whole nation. Outside the region, it was shocking. It was horrifying. It was unacceptable.
It brought the civil rights movement into people's homes, with many American families watching the 6 o'clock news in such a way that it simply just couldn't be ignored.
In just a week, the demonstrators' nonviolent response created a public outcry that Birmingham could not dismiss. On May 10th, symbols of segregation, like separate water fountains, became relics as city leaders signed the Birmingham Truce. In addition, a plan was agreed upon to desegregate lunch counters. This was the kind of meaningful negotiation Martin Luther King had called for in his letter. We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Frankly, I have yet to engage in a direct action campaign that was well-timed in the view of those who have not suffered unduly from the disease of segregation. For years now, I've heard the word, wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never. We must come to see with one of our distinguished jurists that justice too long delayed is justice denied. These words had inspired citizens young and old to take direct action in the streets of Birmingham. The letter was soon published in newspapers and magazines, and its power was undeniable. King had gone to Birmingham to fight injustice. In the end, his most powerful weapon was the letter he wrote from the confines of a jail cell.
The following program was produced by the United States Courts.
As the story goes, in December of 1955, a 42-year-old seamstress named Rosa Parks was arrested for refusing to move from the white section of a bus because her feet hurt, launching the famed Montgomery bus boycott. In reality, she was neither in the white section, nor was she too tired to stand. She was simply tired of giving in. And the story doesn't start there. But Rosa Parks' actions brought the crisis to a head, turning the nation's eyes to Montgomery and the issue over to the federal courts.
The mid-60s, the state of affairs in Montgomery was substantially the same as it was throughout the South. There were laws on the books that provided for separation of the races in almost every public situation. And that's all any African American in Montgomery knew anything about. But I realized that it didn't have to be that way.
And that change began on a downtown Montgomery bus the afternoon of March 2nd, 1955, when 15-year-old Claudette Colvin was arrested on her way home from school for refusing to give up her seat to a white passenger.
She had been taught that she had a constitutional right. She was not sitting in the section reserved for white people. She had paid her fare just like the white people had paid theirs. We tried her case. He found her to be a delinquent. We appealed that case to the circuit court, and ultimately the case was dismissed.
Rosa Parks was very involved in the Montgomery Improvement Association, the NAACP. and other organizations to advance the rights of African Americans. She was neither quiet nor reserved.
If we were going to solve these problems, she also knew it was going to take lawsuits in order to do it. She didn't know whether she would ever be asked to get up to give up her seat. But if the opportunity presented itself, I felt that she would refuse to give up her seat.
On December 1, 1955, Rosa Parks boarded a bus here in downtown Montgomery and sat in the colored section. When the white section filled up and she was asked to move, Rosa Parks did just as Claudette Colvin did. She refused and was arrested. The news of her arrest spread quickly, and a few days later, the African American community rallied to commence the Montgomery bus boycott.
The decision was made that we was going to file a lawsuit. So we was claiming federal constitutional rights, and for those rights to be held, it had to be filed in federal court.
The question was how to make a case that you could bring in federal court, and that's what he did with Browder versus Gale.
I had our leaders checking with people to see who had had problems on the buses and letting me know who would be willing to be plaintiffs.
In the months leading up to Rosa Parks' protest, four other women were arrested for the same offense. Ordinary people. A widow with six children, a secretary, a schoolgirl, and a teenage churchgoer. On behalf of them and others, attorney Fred Gray filed Browder versus Gale, a federal class action lawsuit against Mayor Gale and the city of Montgomery to end segregation on the city's buses.
When Judge Johnson got this case, the chief judge of the circuit would then appoint two other judges to the case, and Judge Reeves was appointed and Judge Lynn was appointed.
That case was decided in a 2-1 vote with Judge Reeves and Judge Johnson declaring the ordinances and state statutes to be unconstitutional.
Judge Johnson had been raised in a segregated culture. Judge Reeves had been raised in a segregated culture, and not just a segregated culture, but this very culture in Montgomery. And yet, they both rendered this decision, which was essentially counter to the very culture in which they had been raised.
On November 13, 1956, that decision was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court and set precedent for numerous civil rights cases that followed. As a result, the African American community in Montgomery ended the year-long bus boycott.
The decision was based on a provision in the United States Constitution, in particular in the 14th Amendment, that says that persons cannot be denied the equal protection of the law. This means that all of us are entitled to equal protection regardless of our race or our religion or some other impermissible factor.
Little did we know when we started it that what happened in Montgomery has helped to change the landscape of this country. And at least it gives hope and courage to people to say, if the 40,000 African Americans in Montgomery, Alabama, to stay off of the buses 382 days, then whatever problems we have, if we work together and make plans together, we may be able to solve those problems too.
I think the Founding Fathers wanted to develop a judiciary that was independent, that's why we were appointed for life, and that could render decisions that were not influenced by either the President or Congress. And it's that independence that allowed the judiciary, in particular the federal judiciary, to carry out the Constitution here in the South.
If we are to get to where we need to be, it's going to have to be federal judges who will be able to decide these cases and not be afraid of what someone may say or what may happen.
Decades after Rosa Parks stood up for her rights as a person of color, she remains an example of how all citizens can assert their rights by turning to the courts, the guardians of the Constitution.
Okay, so I'm not going to play that last clip because it's too long. So I got about 5 minutes left. So, so I just wanted to present this since you know this anniversary took place last week, which made it 64 years. Yeah, 64 years ago, last week. Still think it's very important.
Getting back to what I was talking about, A.G. Gaston, he two books on him. One is called Black Titan, T-A-N, and the other is called Green Power. Good books to read. The John Washington should be another point that you cover, and I can add some good information on that too, and what they call the Big Six and who helped fund it. Alfred P. Sloan was the president of General Motors, and actually that desegregation of the buses, which was really put in place back around the time of Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal, as it had applied to riding on railroad cars. And it was just being replayed out again. Now, you know, blacks wasn't agree. A lot of blacks did not agree with the 1954 Brown versus Board. People there in Easton, I guess, think it was Easton, Pennsylvania. I'm not sure. Easton, Florida. They was against it because you know why? It destroyed some black schools. And you in North Carolina, I think they had a school there in North Carolina in Williston. Williston was all black high school. And the courts ordered it to be integrated. And that school hadn't performed as well. I don't know if it's still in existence. Then there was another one I can't think of the name of it. But anyway, thus is life. Oh, by the way, too, you talk about people and their past. That 9-0 decision on Brown, which was in Thurgood Marshall argued that with the NAACP legal team in front of the court, you had at least one, maybe two Supreme Court justices on the court that were former Ku Klux Klan members. One for sure was Hugo Black. And I'm not positive. I think Justice Warren was also at one point in time a Ku Klux Klan member. I think he was a member for a short period of time, he says, and he got out of it. So it just goes to show you, you know, I'm very argumentative with people and putting the facts out there that people are human beings. And King, they came up north, and blacks did not receive in every spot his type of politics, his movement. You had preachers that didn't want him to come to their city. St. Louis was one of them. So, what went on in the South was not going on in the North. And blacks had a different perspective of things then. It was college students that rode freedom buses from the North to the South in order to participate and help in the organizing that went on.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Okay.
In the Montgomery bus boycott, but the March on Washington. And all this had to do with six black organizations, an NAACP Southern Leadership Conference, Southern Poverty, Urban League. It was another one, a black woman's league that this female, she was head of, she was part of that. They ran out of money. They couldn't get no money, nobody to bail them out. So a group of 10 white businesses, you can say corporations, and they told them, you need to stop doing these things separate. You need to come together on this. And the guy who done that pleading with him was a man by the name of Stephen Correa. And I think he was married to a lady by the name of Audrey Mellon, who the daughter of the Andrew Mellon of the Mellon Foundation. And Malcolm X talks about that in one of his speeches, where they offered the group $1.5 million. I think they gave them $800,000 or $700,000. And before the march and after the march, they gave them the rest of the money in order to fund the organization. One group that came out of that was SNCC. We know SNCC. And they didn't give SNCC as much money as they gave the rest of the organizations when they divided the money up, because SNCC was led by what was called a radical. It was out of SNCC which preceded Black Power. And the people that was involved in the, you know, NAACP, Southern Poverty, and Southern Christian, they didn't want to have nothing to do with Black Power. Not Andrew Young, but his brother Whitney Young sort of made that statement. Now, everything I said may not be to a T, but it's pretty close. And, of course, after the Civil Rights Movement came to a head, then it started on with the Black Power Movement.
Well, I am out of time for this week.
Put another quarter in the machine.
I wish. I got to get ready for work. I have to go to work tonight. So,
all right, I'll try to catch you next week. But get those books.
All right, I'll be back.
All right, I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Okay, all right. Yeah, I'll be back next week. I'm not sure what I'll be talking about next week, but I'll be back next week. Thank you for my phone calls I got tonight. Thank you for listening. And I'll be back next week with another topic for you. Peace out.